Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it is all focused. Everything we're trying to do is focus on full compliance with the Constitution. Now, don't forget, we have, you know, the prayer circle. There's the Loudoun Liberty Prayer Circle. If you're more than welcome to join. The information is still on the website. And on top of that, again, pray, learn, or learn, pray, act in that order. I want to get it right. More importantly, everything we're trying to do and everything we must do is we have to hold our government fully accountable. We can't just say, well, we can accept these violations but not these. We have to hold everything to where they are functioning within full authority and no more assumed authority, no more unconstitutional tyranny, period. Then we can start figuring out where we need to go from there. And I'm telling you, folks, we're a very resilient nation. We can do this. We can do this. That being said, welcome back, Tammy and Sean.
Good to be here, sir.
Okay. And Tammy, yep. There's Tammy. Welcome back. All right, so we are currently in the throes of the Articles of Confederation. We just wrapped up with the 7th article, and we're now going to go into the 8th article, which is almost halfway through the document. So all that being said, I guess technically it might be halfway, but close. We're getting there. So with Article 8, actually, Sean, did you have any go-backs? Because we kind of had to end abruptly when they talked about the land forces and so forth. Anything regarding the common defense?
No, sir.
Okay. Now, one of the things that's interesting, because this came up in the Constitution ratification, the ratification debates of the Constitution, about this common defense and welfare clause. And it's actually in the Articles of Confederation. Very similar language to what is in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And so as we look at how it was understood back in those days, there was never a concept that the federal or the general government had any ability to utilize money for whatever welfare that they wanted. The welfare, the general welfare and defense clause, or the common defense and general welfare clause is what they, I think it was called, that was only pertaining to the powers delegated. The reason they could go to war and create trade agreements was for the common defense and general welfare, not a granting of a specific power. And so it was basically argued by Governor Edmund Randolph, Madison, George Nicholas. There were plenty that stood up and said, look, that does not grant any specific power at all. And it was never assumed under the Articles of Confederation to grant any of that power. This conversation never occurred when the Articles of Confederation were presenting it. And now you want to say, oh, well, that's an evil clause. No, sorry. It's a preamble. The powers being delegated afterwards would be for naught if that actually was granting power. That the reason we're listing the powers is those powers are for the general defense and or the common defense and general welfare of the Union. That's why the powers are being given. Anyway, all right, so let's dive into Article 8. And Tammy, let's just warm you up with picking that up and reading that for us, if you would, please. Thanks.
Okay. All charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare and allowed by the United States and Congress assembled shall be defrayed out of a common treasury, which shall be supplied by the several states in proportion to the value of all land within each state, granted or surveyed for any person, as such land and the buildings and improvements thereon shall be estimated according to such mode as the United States and Congress assembled shall from time to time direct and appoint. The taxes for paying that proportion shall be laid and levied by the authority and direction of the legislatures of the several states within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled.
Okay, so there they mentioned that common defense, or yeah, the common defense and general welfare clause. And the way it was stipulated, it wasn't granting any power. It was basically stating that they, you know, all the taxes that they're going to use is for those very specific powers of general, or yeah, general defense or common defense and general welfare. So anyway, don't know why that trips me up, but let's dive into this next article, which is Article 9, and this is kind of long. So Sean and Tammy, let's kind of break this down by paragraph so that that way we can, one, have a break, and you guys can take turns. Go ahead, Sean, pick up the first in red on Article 9.
The United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of determining on peace and war, except in the cases mentioned in the sixth article, of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering into treaties and alliances, provided that no treaty of commerce shall be made whereby the legislative powers of the respective states shall be restrained from imposing such imposts and duties on foreigners as their own people are subjected to, or from prohibiting the exportation or importation of any species of goods or commodities whatsoever, of establishing rules for deciding in all cases what captures on land or water shall be legal, and in what manner prizes taken by land or naval forces in the service of the United States shall be divided or appropriated, of granting letters of marque and reprisal in times of peace, appointing courts for the trial of piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and establishing courts for receiving and determining finally appeals in all cases of captures, provided that no member of Congress shall be appointed a judge of any of the said courts.
Okay, so when necessary, how do they come up with a court? Congress will define what that court is and basically appoint a judge. In other words, there was no permanent judiciary at all. And if Congress can't settle the dispute and it needs to go into court, they will establish the court for the case. In other words, if all of a sudden they had an overrun and they got like eight cases that came, you know, descended upon them, then they'd have to set up either eight courts or four courts to handle two cases each. However, it was to their discretion. Full discretion over the judiciary. You kind of see that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, Tammy, not sure how your feelings on that, but let's dive into the next paragraph.
Yeah, makes sense.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I just, that I was muted, but as you were saying that, I was like, oh, wow, yeah. Ah, that makes sense.
Awesome. Well, so when they created the judiciary under the U.S. Constitution, it was still a very passive court. It didn't have the ability to do what it does today at all. Not at all. And its jurisdiction was very limited to only those things arising under the Constitution. So anyway, let's go ahead and take this next paragraph. It's a long one, but anyway, you can do it. We know you can. Anyway.
Okay.
All right.
United States and Congress assembled shall also be the last resort on appeal in all disputes and differences now subsisting or that hereafter may arise between two or more states concerning boundary, jurisdiction, or any other causes whatever, which authority shall always be exercised in the manner following. Whenever the legislative or executive authority or lawful agent of any state in controversy with another shall present a petition to Congress stating the matter in question and praying for a hearing, notice thereof shall be given by order of Congress to the legislative or executive authority of their own of the other state in controversy, the day assigned for the appearance of the parties by their lawful agents, who shall then be directed to appoint by joint consent commissioners or judges to constitute a court for hearing determining the matter in question. If they cannot agree, Congress shall name 3 persons out of each of the United States, and from the list of such persons, each party shall alternately strike out 1, the petitioners beginning, until the number shall be reduced to 13, and from that number not less than 7, nor more than 9 names as Congress shall direct, shall in the presence of Congress be drawn out by lot, and the persons whose names shall be so drawn, or any 5 of them, shall be commissioners or judges to hear and finally determine the controversy. So always as a major part of the judges who shall hear the cause shall agree in the determination. If either party shall neglect to attend at the day appointed without showing reasons, which Congress shall judge sufficient, or being present shall refuse to strike, the Congress shall proceed to nominate 3 persons out of each state, and the Secretary of Congress shall strike on behalf of such party absent or refusing the judgment and sentence of court to be appointed in the manner before prescribed shall be final and conclusive. And if any of the parties shall refuse to submit to the authority of such court or to appear or defend their claim or cause, the court shall nevertheless proceed to pronounce sentence or judgment which shall in like manner be final and decisive, judgment or sentence and other proceedings being in either case transmitted to Congress and lodged among the acts of Congress for the security of the parties concerned, provided that every commissioner, before he sits in judgment, shall take an oath to be administered by one of the judges of the Supreme or Superior Court of the state, where the cause shall be tried well and truly to hear and determine the matter in question, according to the best of his judgment, without favor, affection, or hope of reward, provided also that no state shall be deprived of territory for the benefit of the United States.
Okay, so wow, that's kind of, so in other words, they're creating like a panel of judges and a body commissioners, which would be the jury that would be coming from each of the states. And it seems like that there's this, and, you know, if these people don't show up, then, you know, they're going to kind of move forward. So it's almost like we're going to make sure we extract justice in the cause, but we don't have teeth to force the formation and teeth to enforce the execution of the judgment. Does that make sense? Okay.
No.
So in other words,
yeah, that makes sense.
So they're it's interesting that they're preserving in each of the cases, because our current federal system does not have a commissioners or a jury making judgment. It is actually a panel of judges that makes the judgment, right? Like the circuit courts as well as the Supreme Court, that's just a panel of judges. And mm-hmm. I find it interesting because that was one of the big contentions. And I know you went through a couple of years with the ratification debates, how they really, I'll just say the states that vigorously debated the ratification debates, those states were really hot on the fact that the trial by jury was not being upheld at the federal level. In other words, they didn't maintain this idea of selecting people out of every state to participate as commissioners in delivering a verdict. I think that's interesting. But the reality is that the essence that they really hammered about in the ratification debates was this, that they wanted to have a trial by jury of their peers from the same vicinage. So when we kind of look at, you know, what the federal government did, this is the problem. Because certain states didn't have common law invoking trial by jury in the same way other states did, and because some states didn't even have judiciaries, because so many states were so different, the federal court couldn't create a system that they could lock in. So they had to create, and I've said this time and time again, they had to create a federal judiciary that was adaptive to the states, not the other way around. How did we get into this quagmire where we've got this powerful judiciary that tells us how we're going to function and what we're going to do? This goes back to those Federalist Papers and what Alexander Hamilton fed the judiciary in those last 7 or 8 Federalist Papers that he added to the Federalist Papers themselves. Anyway, Sean, let's go ahead and pick up the next 2 paragraphs. I'll kind of let you do a little longer stint here. Go ahead.
All right.
Thank you.
All controversies concerning the private right of soil claimed under different grants of 2 or more states, whose jurisdictions as they may respect such lands, and the states which pass such grants are adjusted. The said grants, or either of them, being at the same time claimed to have originated antecedent to such settlement of jurisdiction, shall on the petition of either party to the Congress of the United States be finally determined as near as may be in the same manner as I before prescribed for deciding disputes respecting territorial jurisdiction between different states. The United States and Congress assembled shall have also the sole and exclusive right and power of regulating the alloy and value of coins struck by their own authority or by that of respective states, fixing the standards of weights and measures throughout the United States, regulating the trade and managing all affairs with the Indians, not members of any of the states, provided that the legislative right of any state within its own limits be not infringed or violated, establishing or regulating post offices from one state to another throughout all the United States, and exacting such postage on the papers passing through the same as may be requisite to defray the expenses of the said office, appointing all officers of the land forces in the service of the United States, excepting regimental officers, appointing all of the officers of the naval forces, and commissioning all officers whatever in the service of the United States, making rules for the government and regulation of the said land and naval forces, and directing their operations.
Okay, so some of this is similar, but what's interesting in the very front end of this is this very first line that says, all controversies concerning the private right of soil claimed under different grants of 2 or more states. Interesting. So what they're not saying here, and what I'm trying to get my arms around is the right of soil. Now, if the land belongs to the federal government for keeping, in other words, a territory has been established, it is property that is the territory of the United States, it's the keeping of this land for the Union, and the intent of this land is to become a state in the Union. The federal government was never granted, when it comes to property, any soil rights at all on any land that was to become states, or even the soil rights of federal property acquired out of states. In other words, when a state sold some parcels of land to become forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and needful buildings, that was not a transfer of soil rights to the federal government for that land itself. The question is where, because the whole point is when somebody buys property, the soil rights come with that property. There has never been an amendment. There has never been a clarity in the ratification debates that stated otherwise. That the bottom line is whoever is buying the property has the right of soil. Now, when we look at the corporations and everything that they started doing and taking all of the rights, that you just have a right to have a building on these acres that you kind of rent, so to speak. Well, the government doesn't have the authority to do that. They don't have the authority to hold those holdings and just allow you to be a renter. They'd have to have an amendment to basically grant them the ability, and or the states, the ability to do these things, as well as the banks. Bottom right, property rights are fundamental, and property rights are considered sacred in our republic. So the soil rights is critical. And we saw that Thomas Jefferson tried to create an amendment that would have actually granted soil rights to the federal government in the Louisiana Territory. And I think you were part of that reading last year when we read that amendment. Correct, Sean?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. So to be clear, folks, Thomas Jefferson felt it necessary and saw a huge advantage of giving the federal government the ability to create corporations and so forth in mining and extracting so that they could actually have their own production of ironworks, tools, machinery, so forth and so on. The problem is, and this goes back to the early days of the Constitution and the Constitutional Convention, we found out that Madison stated in the Bank Act that the concept of corporations and charters were brought up for the federal government to be able to create corporations and charters, you know, charters for governments or charters for institutions like NGOs or what have you. It was brought up and rejected by the body that the federal government was not to be able to do that. So that this constitutional amendment would have basically opened the door to possibly do that, but it didn't grant that. So it would have created a problem. And I'm not sure if that was one of the reasons. I really doubt that that was one of the reasons why Congress rejected the amendment. I believe Congress rejected the amendment because they wanted the ambiguity that they could just assume powers instead of, you know, being told that they had these limitations of this property. They were going down the path by 1803 of thinking that maybe they can just start assuming all of this because the states will get away with it because the states will let them, possibly. That didn't really start happening until 1816. But that was just 13 years later, when they started pulling these shenanigans. But anyway, anything else to add, Tammy, Sean, anything, before we move into the next paragraph?
Nope.
Okay. So, Tammy, go ahead and pick up this next paragraph.
The United States and Congress assembled shall have authority to appoint a committee to sit in the recess of Congress to be nominated a committee of the states, consist of one delegate from each state, and to appoint such other committees and civil officers as may be necessary for managing the general affairs of the United States under their direction, to appoint one of their members to preside, provided that no person be allowed to serve in the office of president more than 1 year in any term of 3 years, to ascertain the necessary sums of money to be raised for the service of the United States, and to appropriate and apply the same for defraying the public expenses, to borrow money or emit bills on the credit of the United States, transmitting every half year to the respective states an account of the sums of money so borrowed and emitted, to build and equip the Navy, to agree upon the number of land forces, and to make requisitions from each state for its quota in proportion to the number of white inhabitants in such state, which requisition shall be binding. And thereupon, the legislature of each state shall appoint regimental officers, raise the men, and clothe, arm, and equip them in a solid like manner at the expense of the United States. And the officers and men so clothed, armed, and equipped shall march to the place appointed and within the time agreed on by the United States and Congress assembled. But if the United States and Congress assembled shall, on consideration of circumstances, judge proper that any state should not raise men or should raise a smaller number of men.
Okay, Tammy, so hold on right there. We're going to pick this up because we're going into break in just a second here. So let's pick it up from right there. And we will be right back, folks, after this short break. understanding you can't kind of look at the length of a paragraph and a couple of minutes we got. Well, okay, so sometimes they're a little bit more cumbersome, so they take a little time. But bottom line, we at least caught it so that we didn't have to start way over again. So let's pick it up right there as clothe, arm, and equip as such extra, and we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, sorry about the unanticipated break in the reading there, Tammy, but let's go ahead and pick it up at that very bottom line, that clothe, arm, okay. Equip, that part right there. Thank you.
I'm not really sure which one we're at, but I'm going to start. And the officers and men, so clothed, armed, and equipped, shall march to the place appointed within the time agreed upon by the United States and Congress assembled. But if the United States and Congress assembled shall, on consideration of circumstances, judge proper that any state should not raise men, or should raise a smaller number of men than the quota thereof, such extra number shall be raised, officered, clothed, armed, and equipped in the same manner as the quota of each state, unless the legislature of such state shall judge that such extra number cannot be safely spread out in the same. In which case they shall raise, officer, clothe, arm, and equip as many of such extra number as they judge can be safely spared. And the officers and men so clothed, armed, and equipped shall march to the place appointed and within the time agreed on by the United States and Congress assembled.
Okay, so talk about very specific, but I'm just going, wow, I mean, it's so specific, it's almost painfully rigid, if that makes sense. And so the simplicity of the Constitution was that they were just to pay for, that the states needed, that Congress would establish the standards. They would establish the disciplines, what needed to be trained. You know, those, they would establish those standards and regulations. And then the states would have the requirement of performing the training and getting the equipment, the uniforms, all that type of stuff from the federal government so that there would be the standard. Because keeping the basic standards in the federal hands would ensure that everybody was going to use 9mm for pistols instead of whatever you wanted to bring to the show. Because bottom line, that means that there may be a lot of pistols that would not be used because they wouldn't have had all the ammo. By allowing them to determine what the technical, and operational equipment of each individual, the TONE, for each individual serving in the militia, that way they would make sure that they would have the spare parts for repairs of broken, guns, rifles, and so forth, as well as the ammo for all of this. If it was left to the states, it would become a nightmare for the federal government, which is why the Constitution gave the power to Congress to kind of maintain and regulate those standards. But in this particular case, it seemed like it was, it was being regulated, but it was not. to the detail, or it what I look at this as problematic, that they were basically giving the states way too much latitude and power, where I think that the states could actually develop an inept or be inept in maintaining a good, well-regulated militia. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, they would have to do it that way.
Right, but because the states had to fund it, what about the states that couldn't fund it? One of the things we learned as we kind of went through the apportionment, when Sean covered this yesterday, he basically said that no less than two, but no more than however many delegates from each state. We learned quickly that after the first year or two, there were states that were not actually attending the Continental Congress at all. In other words, even though it said you had to have two, what states were doing was they were giving proxy to other state delegates, because they couldn't afford to actually man the positions in Continental Congress. So if they couldn't afford to do that, how could they afford to do these things unless Continental Congress was providing for them? They weren't. They couldn't. See, the point is, yeah, that in the Constitution, the federal government was to fund everything, and that the states had the control over the control over the appointment of officers, the training, and to execute the disciplining. In other words, to exercise them and those types of things. So, anywho, that's why I say that that was a plan of success, because the federal government could now tax and make it happen in every state. We had, under the Constitution, an ability to truly create a well-regulated and very secure union and republic. But nobody pushed the issue. And interestingly enough, even though we had a bunch of army men that were occupying the presidency and the offices, you know, Sean, can you identify any decorated, you know, sailor, or I should say captain, admiral of the Revolutionary War of those days?
Not really.
Yeah, why? Because it was just downplayed. I mean, they served a function, but for everybody, the real focus, because Washington was an army, he was a ground pounder. And all of the other real players, I mean, Andrew Jackson, a ground pounder. James Monroe, a ground pounder. Alexander Hamilton, a ground pounder. Why was there really, there was no mention of these sailors that truly contributed, or I should say the captains of the ships and so forth. They were completely downplayed. So I've covered this for a long time, and I look at the way the paradigm was, it was very problematic. And I think that they really should have pushed this, because I think had they pushed the militia, the well-regulated militia, and built the Navy, instead of assuming the debts, actually started, you know, getting the states to put requisitions in to say, this is what we need, to force Congress to actually start paying for this well-regulated militia, and to force Congress to actually start establishing the Navy, I honestly think that had the states done that, then they would have been able to benefit by that money invested in that well-regulated militia to help execute the state laws and pay for, you know, the operations of the militia, when most everything else is being funded by the federal government, if that makes sense. In other words, in a way, the federal government would be literally help subsidizing this deployment of a law enforcement, statewide law enforcement apparatus. Not agency, but apparatus, because each agency would be basically delegated by county. Each county would be its own militia, and each sheriff would be the commander of the militia, and that they would be regulating the laws of the county. And so anyway, you know, I remember sitting down, and forgive me for going through into this rat hole, but I sat down with the Spokane County police chief a long, long time ago. and sat down and said, you know, where would you guys be if you converted your enforcement agency into the militia? And he kind of looked at me and he goes, wow, I mean, how stupid is that idea? And he kind of gave me that kind of look across the table. I said, well, before you really, you know, castigate me and throw me out like a lunatic, let me just say this, that the militia means that every person, every citizen of the city, if it's the militia, means everybody has a responsibility of enforcing the laws, which means that your enforcement agency would be far more, I'll say, attuned, and you would have, you know, more law enforcement and less violators, if that makes sense. And he kind of looked at me and goes, I never thought of it that way. And I go, but here's the best part, that the equipping would be paid for by the federal government, that the training would be paid for by the federal. In other words, your burden of being able to, you know, get your forces ready and disciplined to be able to do the job, that all be paid for by the federal government. Now, all you got to do is, once everybody's been trained, now all we need to do is regulate them. And bottom line, I believe crime would go down, because you stand to lose a lot more. Because if you, as a militiaman, go out and commit a crime, you would probably lose your right to bear arms. You'd lose everything. So anyway, he gave that some thought.
Would you just take volunteers then?
Well, no. So technically, who's supposed to serve in the militia? It's a class of people. Any person between the age of 17 and another age with the physical capabilities of serving, period. Mm-hmm. That means that everybody needs to be trained. You don't wait to say, okay, we got to go to war, so now we're going to train people. Everybody needs at least to have the fundamental training, you know, and then you work them in from active reserve, inactive reserve, so forth and so on. But by doing that, by creating that type of system, you actually will always maintain a well, because the whole concept, I mean, those words, a well-regulated militia means just that, exactly that.
I think it would have made an immense difference in the way that culture evolved.
Thank you.
It's just a shame that, I mean, if right now you had to raise up people in your community to defend your community, let's say like a fictional Red Dawn scenario where paratroopers started landing in your county, you know, and nobody knew what was going on, and you had to defend your community, we'd be in dire straits. Because half of them would be making deals with the people. I mean, I don't know if you ever saw High Plains Drifter, where they had to enlist all the townspeople to defend themselves against these outlaws. And, of course, it went the way the movie was scripted. But what I'm saying is, think about the difference in the mentality and the worldview of our youth if they were required to have serious disciplined training of, you know, home defense and law enforcement. It'd be a whole different scenario.
And I say thank you. Not thank you because it's my idea, because it's not. Thank you for recognizing this divine design, because it's almost like I have no recollection of heaven, but I would think every person in heaven is an acting agent in defending heaven and keeping it, you know, righteous and, you know, keeping evil out. And so, you know, there's this obligation that we all have. It changes the paradigm to become a part of the whole instead of being, I mean, it's nice to live in a world where you can just tune in, you know, tune out and get high or whatever you want to do. But I honestly think that that's not acceptable in a civil society. I think that's the problem, is we've allowed that type of slaving, you know, paradigms and behavior to persist. Anyway,
That's like the adage, oh, well, if somebody's breaking in your house, call 911 and let law enforcement handle it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they're doing whatever they want to your family and your property and your life while you're waiting for the police to show up.
There you go. Right. Absolutely. When you have a right to stand your ground, you have more than a right to defend your property, defend your life, and so forth. I think that people have marginalized. And it's amazing to me that when we look at the good things in our society, the good things in our life, why is it that they're demonized? I'll give you a good case in point. Because if we look at the righteous things in our lives, that family is a righteous thing in our lives and in our society, right? It is the bedrock. It is the building block of every society is the family. But it's demonized now. That we want to get rid of that. We can do better by allowing the state to control the family to ad nauseum. Or let's look at another thing, marriage, demonized. Let's look at militia, demonized. They demonize all things that are of good report and of value. Why? Because they know that if these things become a stronghold in our society, it is almost impossible to overturn us, to subvert us, and destroy us.
That's why they want to get rid of God.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, anyway, let's go back into the articles. And let me see here. This means that we're on 10, huh?
I think the second paragraph.
Oh, okay. Okay, so did you not read the United States and Congress assembled, never engage in war, nor grant letters of marque? I thought you did do that. So you
didn't get to the second.
No.
Okay, the last one. Okay. Right. Hey, Tammy,
the Congress of the United States shall have power to adjourn to any time within the year and to any place within the United States so that no period of adjournment be for a longer duration than the space of 6 months and shall publish a journal of their proceedings monthly. Except such parts thereof relating to treaties, alliances, or military operations, as in their judgment require secrecy. And the yeas and nays of the delegates of each state on any question shall be entered on the journal when it is desired by any delegates of a state or any of them. At his or their request shall be furnished with the transcript of the said journal, except such parts as are above accepted, to lay before the legislatures of the several states.
Now, I believe that the secrecy is a real problem. And I believe that the state legislatures should actually be the oversight for the secrecy. Because what ended up happening, even though there was this logical, hey, we need to keep these things secret, I believe that created, I'll just say, this den of iniquity where, we've created this great collection capability of monitoring the world. Why don't we monitor our own people? Let's vilify our own people. Let's vilify people within our society. Like these militia guys over here, they're a threat. Forget about the constitutional protections that we the people have to be secure in our persons and all things. These protections that we have, these privileges and immunities, forget about that. They've created an apparatus, and they've been using it against us. And my point is that who other than the state should have oversight over those things? This is why, and I'll just go into this rat hole really quick. When the narcissist Edward Snowden basically finally executed his long-baked plan. This was not something that occurred as an epiphany. Hey, this is just wrong and I need to do something about it. Wrong. This guy, when you look at the intelligence that he's exposed, much of this stuff that he exposed came from his entire career working with this agency, with the NSA. In other words, he was taking home classified information from his first positions, his earlier positions, not something that, oh, wow, I think that this is wrong and maybe I need to take some of this to expose it. He planned a long time ago to try to get away with doing something. And then he finally figured out, well, maybe I can use this as a justification to protect me, and I can take all of this classified data and basically scorch the United States. So technically, what he was doing, and because we didn't have an apparatus of oversight at the state level, what he was doing was he was planning an act of treason, and everybody wants to make him a hero. When technically what he should have done was he should have taken that information to the states, who should have had constitutional oversight over the entire intelligence apparatus, to basically say, hey, look, where did you get the authority to start listening, to start targeting, to start actually using this system against American citizens? Because the states should have been able to step in, should at any point in time be able to step in and correct the federal government in this intellectual, or I should say, intelligence collection stuff, as well as the intellectual property spying, all of these things that they've been doing. I mean, shoot, corporations get away with intellectual property violations. It's not amazing to me when you start putting things into OneDrive, Google, or putting things into Amazon Web Services, that all of a sudden, it's just like putting your product in Costco. And the next thing you know, Costco, because it's so successful, Costco has manufactured their own duplication and they stop selling yours. That's not a violation of intellectual property. This is all going on. It's going to continue to get worse and worse and worse. The corporations and the governments are going to spy more. They're going to steal more. Eventually, until they kill us all off, they'll continue to basically rape us for our ideas and for our lives and our properties and everything else. And, you know, forgive me for using such a hyperbole, rape. But anywho, I think that most people today feel like, you know, that's what's happening. Anywho, that is that with that. So let's dive into the 10th article. And so, Tammy, you ready?
The Committee of States, or any 9 of them, shall be authorized to execute in the recesses of Congress such of the powers of Congress as the United States and Congress assembled, by the consent of the 9 states, shall from time to time think expedient to vest them with, provided that no power be delegated to said committee, for the exercise of which, by the Articles of Confederation, the voice of 9 states in Congress of the United States assembled be requisite.
Okay, so that's really kind of a convoluted statement. But what do you think that they're saying here? Because this is convoluted, isn't it? So they're talking about the Committee of the States, which is this, not Continental Congress, but another committee that when they're in recess, right, shall be authorized to execute in the recess of Congress. So in other words, the states can then send delegates into a committee, but it needs to be, what, of 9 states, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yep. So they have to have at least 9 states to do this, but they can't have any power that has not been, they can't assume power that's not within the article, it's got to be within the Articles of Confederation. They can't just assume power is not granted, kind of thing. This never happened that I know of. And I say that because the states didn't want to spend more money on more government at the federal level. Because at this point, it was the creation of the Articles of Confederation, though it was a big benefit to protect ourselves from the aggressions of Britain, after the war of 17, once the treaty of 1783, there was no need for these states to even convene any committees anymore. And this is when we actually started seeing the permanent removal, or basically no longer certain states being represented in Continental Congress, in violating the Articles of Confederation itself. So it's interesting that they put this in here, but I think that they failed to realize when they created this, who had the ability and the money to be able to maintain this governing body. And especially when it had to be subsidized by the states, because the states were not willing to pay the taxes to this governing body, to the general government of this Continental Congress. I mean, they don't want to fund it. They don't even want to pay the debts. In other words, hey, it was great that we had this thing. Now let's just go back to being independent sovereign states. But nobody had the audacity to say, let's just get rid of this. Because the day they did that, what would happen? Any ideas, Sean? Any ideas, Tammy? What would happen if the states basically said, let's disassemble the Articles of Federation, let's go back to independent sovereign states?
Oh, Britain would have took them apart piece by piece.
Well, there's that, but there's another problem. We would have obtained very quick enemies because Continental Congress created debt, and they apportioned that debt out to the states. And now these states say, well, we're not obligated by that. In other words, these states could have really taken American politics to a new low. So they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to be that scrupulous. So, Sean, let's go ahead and do the 11th article. And we got about 2 minutes so we can do this and then kind of wrap up. Go ahead.
Canada acceding to this confederation and adjoining in the measure of the United States shall be admitted into and entitled to all of the advantages of this union, but no other colony shall be admitted into the same unless such admission be agreed to by 9 states.
Okay, so in other words, they opened up this union to Canada. They opened it up. Funny thing is, in 1783, 2 years after this document was ratified, a whole bunch of people were kicked out of the United States and ended up going to Canada, hating America because they just lost all their property. They lost everything. And so now Canada was the recipient of these American haters, these British loyalists, the Tories. And so I think it created, and the real reason why Canada had no desire to be associated with this confederation was because of slavery. And I know after the Constitution was ratified, there was an appeal to Canada, I believe it was in the 1790s, to if they wanted to join. And the two matters that were prevailing were the Tories that were kicked out, as well as this concept of slavery being embraced. They didn't want to see slaves coming up there and being protected, because the Constitution would have protected them. So Canada basically says, no, thank you. We don't think that you've got a superior government. Because of those two things that were blemishes on this awesome document. Actually, I won't say the Tories was a blemish. I would basically say that any good government's got to get rid of its enemies. I've said this time and time again. Mohammedans have no place in America. They can't be citizens. They are citizens under false pretense. They are taking an oath to abjure their allegiance to Sharia law, to these different governing bodies, to this other potent, basically as a facade. And we're kind of out of time. So we can pick it up next time with the Mohammedans and the citizenship, since I opened up that rat hole. We can kind of pick that up next time and talk a little bit about citizenship, because it was clear Mohammedans were banned back in those days, but let's make it clearer so that we can talk about it for everybody to provide their 2 cents, their 2 bits, whatever, however much money you bring into the table. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.